Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans, meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shaped the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisisCLE.com/podcast.
What up, everybody? Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. I'm Michael Steele. It is always a pleasure when you drop in the house to hang for a little bit in conversation about what the hell is going on out there. You know, it's crazy. We are less than 3 weeks from voting. We're about to change up the game, and you are an essential part of that. And as you go about the business of planning your vote, right, you're going to plan the vote. Don't forget to wear the damn mask, all right? Because there's a whole lot of stupid people out there, and I don't want to have to look at you and go, you stupid. So do the right thing. Do it smartly. Do it well. So as I mentioned, we are in the campaign season, and that's always a good time for me as an old political hand who've been doing this going back to my days back in D.C. where I grew up. And so this time of year, I always get excited because gives you a chance to sort of really drill down, particularly in the last few weeks of the campaign, of some races out there that you may not have thought about or overlooked, don't know that much about outside of, you know, where they're running, and like to kind of showcase some of the real smart talent that's out there on the campaign trail. And this is one brother that I've gotten to follow a little bit and get to talk to and know over a period of time. And I think he's going to make an excellent congressman from the 30th Congressional District in the great state of Texas. He's none other than Dr. I like to emphasize that, Dr. Trey Penny. He grew up in the inner city of Houston and learned a lot both in his home and on the streets of that city, watching what was transpiring in his neighborhood during the war on drugs era. That experience led him to make a commitment to service to the people where he lived. And so he began that service by working and serving in the United States Army. He served there for 4 years, graduating with an associate's degree in administration of justice from Honolulu Community College, right? Yeah, Honolulu Community College. Then just took to the streets and has been doing a yeoman's work in that area of community advocacy, social change, and in the process, became the executive director of 3 nonprofit organizations designed to assist families of police officers killed or critically injured in the line of duty. Again, paying back the service to his community. And in 2018, instead of taking up a presidential appointment to the White House, brother decided he wanted to make the ultimate commitment and join the United States Congress. So put his name out there on the ballot so he can serve the people of his district directly. He is currently running for the United States House in, like I said, Texas, in the 30th Congressional District. And this is a bit of his platform. He's seeking to fight for the interests of the people, ensure greater accountability in reducing crime, enhancing education, growing the economy, and improving the lives of all constituents in Texas and the congressional district there. Welcome, Trey, or doctor, Absolutely. As we like to say.
No, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Nah, it's good to have you, brother. And there's a lot to get into, but let's start with some important business up front so folks know where they can find you. What's your campaign website?
Yes, Penny for Congress. So that's PENNIE for Congress.com.
All right, folks, Penny for Congress. I like my friends who are following me and have been a part of the podcast to help a brother out, as we like to say.
I love it.
But don't do so until after this. I want you to, because I want you make that commitment. You're going to know why you're making that commitment, because he's the real deal. So how do you feel about where things are right now? Before we get into the specifics of your campaign and what you're seeing on the ground, just sort of a top line view of where you see the country and where you see Texas before we get into where you see things in the 30th congressional district. You're a candidate at a time of COVID, civil unrest, flatline economy. How has that shaped your view of the country and where you think the country needs to go?
Oh man, I mean, you hit a lot of hard points. I mean, look, we're dealing with an unprecedented crisis right now. Like you said, all those issues are, we're seeing all these issues come together at once. And unfortunately, it appears that no one has a solution. I mean, I'm just baffled and looking at history and some of the things that we've come through in the past. I mean, looking at the Great Depression, and all the crises that were going on then, and how as a country we were able to come together with the New Deal and put forward ideas to with public works projects to get people working again. I'm just surprised that we hadn't taken that position. Now we have this conflict going on between the federal, state, and local governments. This idea of federalism is just, we've just seen it come apart at the seams, and I'm just, I'm a pragmatic thinker. You know, I like to look for solutions, like to find ways to fix things. And I'm on the ground with the people. You know, whatever works right for the people, I want to be there. And unfortunately, you know, there's so many communities that are getting left behind. I mean, we see the big picture. You know, we see what's happening in, you know, suburban America. And let me tell you, suburban America is able to cope. Unfortunately, you know, the same resources that you see in other places, that's not happening in the inner city. It's just, I'm there every day. And this is, I'm telling you, it's completely different, two different worlds. And I want to bring ideas to fix it. And that's why I'm here right now.
So when you look at your district, give us a sense of what the 30th district looks like in October of 2020.
Well, 30th district, what we have right now is, my screen. So basically what we have right now is, like you said, you have a lot of the social justice issues going on. We just came off a lot of rioting. We've had, this is the southern sector of Dallas County. So you have, it's the inner city anyway, right? So you have the inner city, you have a few pockets of suburban areas. But if you think about it, this is just like other majority minority districts in this country that are classified as majority minority districts, that basically they're comprised of majority ethnic and racial minorities, right? There are 121 of these districts across the country. And unfortunately, these are the districts that have been left behind. You know, these are the districts that, as Republican, you know, Republican parties, we say, they have the high crime, the failing economic system, the, you know, failing schools. Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. And we point to the fact that Democrats are leading those cities. But the reality is Democrats, they overpromise, underdeliver, and the Republican Party simply has no presence. They ignore those areas. Mm-hmm. So what I'm thinking is, look, if we're going to complain, or if we're going to talk about these communities being failing, then why don't we run legitimate candidates in those areas? Why don't we go out here and actually show what our solutions are to fix it? And I tell people all the time that, look, I'm a Republican because I'm a conservative. I'm not a conservative because I'm a Republican. And I want people to understand that, because my ideas, I believe in limited government, right? I believe in the rule of law, national sovereignty. These basic premises that that formed this idea of conservatism that we've completely moved away from within the Republican Party, especially fiscal conservatism. I bet I ever hear another Republican tell me anything about fiscal conservatism.
You got that ish right. You better not step up in my face talking about debts and deficits that we're staring at $1 trillion deficit at the end of this year. And so what in your estimation, Trey, got the party to the point where big government republicanism became the order of the day? You saw it emerge during Bush 43's year. And there's a rationale for that to some extent. Because of 9/11 and the emphasis in trying to ramp up on a war footing. But even that was tricky and some thought impetuous. Certainly a lot of traditional Republicans did not appreciate this sort of long march into conflict, whereas the neocons, as they became known as, and the sort of conservative hawks, you know, represented largely by Vice President Cheney, had a different agenda and a different way of looking at that, which again was somewhat antithetical to traditional Republicans. Like you said, yeah, we always stood on the mantle for strong defense. That didn't mean military engagement.
Right.
So you had that, and then of course you had, the level of debt and deficit that were created. And has certainly mushroomed under a President Trump administration. How do you assess that? How do you square that for voters in light of where the party itself has moved? And I would argue that's not really the Republican Party. That is, that there are elements inside of it that are now kind of controlling those levers.
Right.
But how do you square that with the voters in your district? And what do you say to them when they say, well, you know, you guys kicked the crap out of Barack Obama for 8 years. If the brother wanted to spend a penny on something, and here in 3 years, you added $7 trillion to the national debt.
Right. Absolutely. And a lot of that money has not even trickled down to the people. So, in fact, I mean, and look, I'm going into the communities and within the party, and I'm pointing out these fallacies. You know, I'm pointing out the contradictions in their own policies, because the bottom line is, if a lot of times people don't realize when they make these mistakes and these big ideas that have absolutely
come with big price tags, right?
with big price tags, absolutely. You know, they don't even realize it. You know, they never even think about it. Like, oh, you know, this is the best thing for the party, you know. And I'm thinking, like, wait a minute, for whose party, right? This non-inclusive party that you're talking about?
Right.
You know, we got to start getting back to a middle. And I use this jokingly when I tell people, say, look, you know, we can't go to talking about telling people in the inner city to pick themselves up by their bootstraps if we don't give them boots, right?
Right.
That's the reason. You know, people got to have opportunities. You know, if I have not, and I want to just real quick, I gotta let people know about my own struggle in coming through life, right? I came up in the inner city. I had my grandmother's my greatest influence, right? They had a broken family, all these issues going on. This was a wave back then in the early 90s. Like I said, this was the wave of real social justice, right? This was, you know, we were advocating against the police coming in, and guess what? They didn't come. And we were being victimized at a higher rate than anywhere else in the country. In fact, there were criminal gangs in L.A. at the time in the early 90s, and we were being victimized at a higher rate than they were in L.A.
Right.
President Bush had to launch his war on drugs in the park across the street from my grandmother's house because of the level of violence that we had in Houston at the time. And I say that everyone's an advocate until they become a victim, because I had to become a victim at a young age. At the age of 16, I witnessed my cousin get killed in front of me the day before her wedding day. It changed my life. Right.
Wow.
It made me think, like, okay, well, maybe we do need the police. And the great thing about it, though, Michael, was that the officers that showed up, they didn't look like me. Right. So you had the radicals out here saying, hey, you know, the white people are against us, the police are against us. But you know what? Those guys came out. They treated my family with respect. And my family was the one, you know, not you know, this whole idea of no snitching and whatever. I mean, they were, you know, we were all right out there. Everyone knows. But the fact of the matter was, that was the most influential time of my life, the most hurtful time, But that's what led me into going to law enforcement. Now, that's why I look, I've been a police officer for 21 years, and I see that same cycle recurring over again in these underserved majority minority districts, because we're not putting the resources down. We're not putting the infrastructure in place to allow people opportunities to achieve. I did the most controversial thing anybody could have done at the time, which was join the United States Army. And I know I say controversial because nobody was talking about it. Nobody, look, when I went for the Army, people hated me. People in my own family hated me for making that decision. But right. You know what? The best thing I could have done, I thank God every day for the United States Army, because I wouldn't be here today. Now, as Dr. Trey Pitty running for United States Congress, right?
Yeah, nah. Look, there's so much power in story, so much power in struggle, and when you are blessed with recognition. In other words, a lot of folks walk around, Trey, and you know brothers like this, who don't recognize their own story, and they don't recognize the power of their own story. They give into that story and they get consumed by that story. And, right. You know, God has a way of sending along triggers to help you and that sort of jolt you sometimes move you gently. But God has a way of taking care of those that he knows. Yeah, you need this right now. So here's a little something to help you do what you need to do next. And it could be a conversation with someone. It could be a phone call that comes. It could be something I've had in my own life, moments where I'm just sitting there watching a movie. I don't know why the hell I turned this movie on. And my family tell you, you do this all the time, that you run. I mean, it doesn't matter. You walk into the middle of a you know, 3-hour movie and you're consumed by it. Okay, fine, I get it. But I'm like watching a movie and all of a sudden the message I needed to hear is made clear right in there. Something as innocuous as a movie I just randomly picked up on TV. So,
you know, I'm glad you bring that up though, because you know, when I had to make the decision of whether or not to go to DC or to stay home, it was right around the time there was a 9-year-old, there was a drive-by in one of our inner city apartment complexes here in Dallas. And a 9-year-old got shot and killed, right? And it was, you know, I'm a law enforcement advocate. So I'm typically dealing with issues of police officers killed in line of duty, and I go out and respond. One of the community advocates called me up and asked me, can I come out and deal with the family? Because this was, I mean, it was really heated. It was, you know, this baby had, you know, it was a drop, basically some gangsters or whatever drove mm-hmm. by and got up the wrong house, and a 9-year-old was, you know, playing a game and got hit. So they called me to come out. I go out and I engage the community, got everything calmed down. But you know, I realized through that situation, I'm like, man, you know, who's out here advocating for the people? You know, who's talking, who's doing this, right? And that was like the pivotal point for me to say, hey, you know what? I'm supposed to be here. You know, I'm supposed to come out here and I'm supposed to fight for the interests of the people. You know what? Let me give these families opportunities. There's so many stories I can go on and on about this stuff happening. We hear these stories when they talk about a police officer shoots and kills somebody, whatever, right? That's mm-hmm. the whole social justice narrative, right? But the reality is, man, we got kids getting killed out here in the community every day. I mean, this is real, you know? And none of those stories don't even make the headlines. Those stories don't even make it into the news. And I just see, especially with that particular situation, that was a white officer that tried to save that baby. Till this day, that family loves that officer. They asked me to use one of my campaign events to invite the officer out so they can present him with an award. Wow. That's how the community is in loving their police and wanting to have this interaction with their leaders. Look, I'm there. Nobody can deny that I'm not there. I'm there.
Right. And I know. So Dr. Trey, how do you bring that to Congress? What does that look like? Because one of the things I'm all about, and it's part of my Catholic upbringing, my time in a monastery. So I'm all about servant leadership and what that means and the power of that. Not for me, but for others, because that is the fullness of service when you euphemistically kiss the feet of those you serve. There's that moment in the passage in the Bible where the woman washes Jesus' feet with her tears, dries his feet with her hair, and anoints his feet with oil, and then kisses them, which, you know, is a sign of that service, that servant attitude. How do you bring that to Congress in a place that I, in growing up Washington, have watched changed dramatically? What do you do on your first day? What was the first piece of legislation that you think you introduced? How do you bring your agenda, your voice, not your voice, excuse me, the voice of the people of the 30th Congressional District to Congress? What does that sound and look like legislatively?
Yeah, I put out a series of policies. I actually got them on my website. And what I did was I created the Earn It Plan, right? So we're talking about economic academic reward network, right? So this is basically, I want to get people to work, right? I want to make sure, forget the trickle down effect, right? These are real ideas that I think that this is bipartisan, right? This sells itself, right? And we completely forget the fact that people just want opportunities. And if we can work together to create these opportunities, we can create this engine, this economic engine for America that will allow so many people to work, not relying on the gig economy, like real jobs, train them for careers. But it has to be a three-pronged approach. It has to have government. So government has to play its role in terms of the leadership factor, providing the programs that are needed to go forward, right? Whatever those programs are to move the economy forward, we got to have the government doing its part. Then you have corporations. So that's what I've been doing is networking, right? It's a big part of it. If you network with these corporations, want tax benefits, right? They want to be involved. We got to bring them into the fold. So I'm going to be networking with these companies and allowing these companies to play a role in helping to uplift these underserved communities. And then most importantly, we got to get the people involved. We got to have the people playing a role in their own outcomes, right? This is not forget the government doing it for us. The government has already shown that they're not going to do anything for you, right? You've been sitting around rather than waiting on, think about this stimulus, right? This last stimulus. We're sitting around waiting for the government to give $1,200 to the people, okay? When we could have used that $3 trillion that they did before, and we could have created jobs, we could have put forward projects, infrastructure projects. Matter of fact, let's just go back to the riots, right? We had all these cities destroyed with vandalism. Now, how about we pay people to go clean up that mess? How about that? Right? You don't think that we can use these are the economic engines that I'm talking about. Let's put stuff in place. Let's not give money to corporations that are going to blow it. And then a couple of months later, right, they're going to lay everybody off and then nobody has a job.
Yeah, lay them off anyway. Yeah.
I mean, that's really what we've done. And we're blowing so much money. And it's not even the people aren't benefiting. And I want the people to have a voice. And this is all people, right? This is people not just in suburban America, right? You got to get people in underserved communities to be able to have an opportunity to succeed. Right?
So how does your message resonate with your district? I know, you know, broadly speaking, a lot of, you know, center right, center left individuals and even some folks on the edges, whether they're on the progressive side or the hard conservative side, you know, see the value of some of what you're saying, particularly around the social justice piece, around the economic renewal piece. In some cases, it's more semantics. You know, you say potato, I say potato kind of deal. But how do you move the needle in your district? Is it a combination of forces that you as a member of Congress can give attention to, you know, so maybe education and, a sort of manufacturing base, sort of linking those together. Again, not knowing a whole lot about your district, but what do you see there that's shapeable and transformable for your people so that 2 years from this November, when you would be up for reelection, you can look back and say to those very same people, this is what my leadership did you know, and it may just be one thing. In these 18 months, you know, from the time I get into the office to the time I'm running again, it's going to work out to about 18 months. This was the commitment, and this was the deliverable. What does that look like? Give people a sense of how you translate vision into reality.
That looks like accountability. That looks like being available. That looks like showing people how to actually go to Congress and get something done. That means actually drawing up legislation, right? I'm not going to be, you know, so many politicians think that they can just get that they can just allow policy to go forward and let their aides write the policy for them, and then that just be it. They sign off for it and be done. I'm a hands-on person, okay? I want to read everything. Yeah, so if you write a 400-page report, I'm going to read this report. We're mm-hmm. going to get through this report. And the reality is I'm going to come in with ideas, fresh ideas. I'm going to draw up these policies, and this is going to be written. This is going to be bipartisan, and I can go to everyone and say, you know what, give me your feedback. Before we even bring this to the floor, let's go ahead and have these things and let's address your issues up front. And I think so many, because we're so polarized in our ideas, Congress, you got Democrats don't talk to Republicans don't talk to Democrats. Forget that nonsense, right? I'm talking about accountability. I'm talking about where people can say, hey, this is what we know Trey Penny did. This is his policies, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, where it landed is whether or not I need to work through committee or whatever to get it done, my people are going to know that. And I want people, think about the last time you've been able to read any piece of legislation before it was actually voted on, right? It just simply doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. And I want that transparency to be available for constituents to be able to go to my website, or better yet, call my office and find out exactly what this piece of legislation is. Somebody should be available, right? That's what I want them to see.
For elections for me, when I was, you know, working with candidates as a county chairman or running for office myself, elections are not about running against someone or something. It's running for something, right? And for me, it was always running for the people I wanted to serve here in Maryland. And I tell candidates that should be their priority. However, you still got an opponent in the race. You're still running, quote, against someone. How do you assess? You've used this word now several times, more than several times, and I think it's important. It kind of goes to the question in the conversation that we're having, and that word is accountability. How you sort of set out how you want to account to your voters. Your opponent in this race has been in office a long time.
28 years.
How many? 28 years?
28 years.
28 years. So how do you reconcile through this mechanism of accountability, you know, a 28-year service to this community? How do you get them to appreciate that maybe they've not gotten 28 years worth of value out of that? Again, not making it a red versus blue thing, right. A partisan thing, but as some, you got to draw that contrast. How do you do that? And so that people, so it's not about vote for me because you hate the other guy or they're less value, you know, but vote for me because I'm offering you something better and different than what you're already getting.
Let me tell you this, Mike. Look, she has taken the low road. She's to attack my character, right? That's not my thing. You know, I want to address the issues. I want to address the problems in the community. So what I've done is I've gone directly to the people, and it's not like the people don't know what the problems are. I mean, they know what they are, right? And believe it or not, the people are ready for change.
Right. Your opponent in this race is represent. What's her, it's?
Eddie Bernice Johnson.
Eddie Bernice, that's right. Eddie Bernice Johnson. Right.
Like 28 years in office. You know, like I say, 84 years old. Look, I'm not one of these guys that's going to attack age, but I can just say, you know, realistically, at this point in my life, I'm 42 years old. I just really don't want my grandmother making decisions for me. I mean, you can, you know, people can take that however they want to take it, but that's the reality of what's happening. You know, we got people that are being left behind because of the old way of doing business. Like, this world has changed so much. especially since you took office in 1993. You know, we went from an era.
We didn't have iPhones in 1993. We didn't have iPads. We barely had computers.
That's how much this world has changed, and the people realize. It's not like, you know, I'm thinking that people are going to be pleasantly surprised with this race, because a lot of young people do realize that it's time for change. They realize that these issues from, like I said, the lack of economic development, filling schools, high crime, you know, some of the highest murder rates in the state of Texas, right here essentially in this district. And the people realize that, you know, they realize it's time for change. And I'm uniquely qualified. It's not like, you know, I'm not like one of these, you know, one of these other guys you see, right, you know, throwing their name out there and that, you know, just want to attack the person. Oh, they're bad. I'm good. Nah, you know what? Listen, I'm very appreciative. You know what? Anybody that can serve 28 years in Congress, I appreciate your service. But now it's simply time for change. And I'm going to bring a real story. You know what? I want to tell you this real quick. I don't know how much time I got, but I got
to tell you. Yeah, we're about to go to break, but go ahead.
All right. So look, when I was a young police officer, I used to patrol this area. There's a one apartment complex that had a lot of shootings come out. So as officers, we try to be proactive to be on top of these calls. So I show up at this particular call one day, and like I said, there was this tumultuous relationship between the police and the community, and you know we were just all on top of crime all the time. So I'm driving through the apartment complex, and this little kid was sitting on the curb, and he had his head down between his legs. And I drive up on side of him. I let my window down and say, hey, little man, everything all right? And he look up at me and he say, I'm just tired. And put his head back down. So I get out of my squad car, walk over to him and say, little man, what you tired of? What's wrong? And he say, I'm tired of running. And he look up and I see him and his buddy. I see his buddy riding off on their bikes or whatnot. I say, all right, little man. I say, you know, I jumped in my squad car. I say, well, hold on, wait a second. I'll be right back. I jump in my squad car. And at the time, there used to be an old Toys R Us on down the road. It wasn't close. I was going Code 3, but don't tell nobody.
Lights and sirens, baby. Lights and sirens.
Run in, and I grabbed the best, brightest bike that I could find, man. And I come back, and I throw it in my squad car, and I drive back. And I'm praying the whole time this kid's still sitting there. And, you know, when I get there, and true enough, he was there. You know, he still had his head down in between his legs, and I jumped out the car. And I gave him the bike, and he looked up at me. He said, is this mine? You should have seen the joy I seen on that. You know what? The joy on his face wasn't even comparable to the joy I had to be able to do that. The kid jumped on his bike, and he took off and caught up with his friends. And I tell people that because the reality is this young man represents District 30. We've been sitting on the curb for the last 28 years while everyone else around us has taken off on their bikes. And it's time for us to get ours so we can catch up. That's the reality.
Dr. Trey Penny, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to have more conversation with a bright light that's shining in Texas. We'll be right back.
Everyone loses golf balls, even the pros. When you need golf balls, go to LostGolfBalls.com, the world's largest inventory of used golf balls. All the top brands in stock, 50% off retail. LostGolfBalls.com.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to the Michael Steele Podcast. I'm glad you're hanging with us. We're having a great conversation with Dr. Trey Penny. Penny, candidate for the 30th congressional seat in the great state of Texas, running against Representative Eddie Bernice Johnson, a 14-term member of Congress. We were just talking about your community, which is largely likely representative of a lot of communities around the country, and how folks find themselves just sitting on the curb as everyone else is taking off and getting by them. How do you see the impact of COVID-19, and how would you as a member of Congress deal with that issue? Do you see the package that Nancy Pelosi has put on the table? You hear the response to that from the Republican Senate. What would you be saying in a Republican caucus right now in Congress and potentially next January in light of where we are with COVID-19, 213,000 dead Americans. And actually, I think the number's higher than that now. But how do you see that? What do you say in a Republican caucus to get members to move on what the community needs right now?
We got to stop the bleed. You know, guys, we got to work together. You know, this is today is the public. You see what's happening. The public's dying. But what about when it's tomorrow and it's your family member, right? People got to be able to, they have to be able to feel that this is something that's real, that's going to happen, that potentially can happen to them. And we see this happening across the country to where it's always the, and I write about this in my dissertation, the not me syndrome, right? Because it's not you. You it's okay for you to push it off. You push it off until it does become you. And I think that's where that's the approach that we have to take to Congress, to where I am caucusing with my body. And I'm saying, guys, we have to do something to help the people. We have to stop the bleed. We have to stop allowing. We can't allow half our population to be killed off by a virus. We have to start coming together to create ideas. First of all, it's going to involve a plan. And this plan has to be a plan initiated at the federal level, right? And worked on with the states. We got to get everybody to the table. Forget the Democrat, Republican stuff, because unfortunately, if we continue to operate like that, we are going to have a significant number of deaths across the United States. And this thing's going to keep going. But we got to have a plan in place. It can't simply just be, let's wait until the crisis happens. And we got to look, the minorities in this country are being impacted by this virus more than anyone else. Any other race or red ethnic group in the United States. And we have to realize that they don't have the same resources, right? They don't have the ability. So we know that healthcare is a real issue, right? But let's think about this. The healthcare issues have been an issue, but when you look at what's available in a lot of the majority minority districts for them to eat, man, it just troubles me when I know that there are still food deserts in my district, right? Nobody can go get healthy food, vegetables from a general store in South Dallas. Ain't none. Ain't no Kroger's in South Dallas. You know, and this is where we got to start talking about this, right? These are real issues that are being ignored by partisans because they want to continue this party line, and I think it's time to break it.
So our party has for now 14 years, roughly. Pretty much said that they, and I was on the front lines of this battle back in the day regarding healthcare, as you mentioned, that, you know, Obamacare has all these problems. It's not good for the people. The president's in right now in the Supreme Court looking to overturn Obamacare, which is going to be a hot button issue in this election on the healthcare front because voters are having to weigh whether or not this Supreme Court nominee is that vote to actually overturn Roe versus Wade. I'm still not convinced that Coney Barrett is that individual, but you know that we'll see in short order. But the party has largely done nothing in this space except the rhetoric of repeal and replace without putting a plan on the table. Do you have a plan? Do you have an idea? I mean, you're not a medical doctor, so we'll be clear about that. So I'm not asking you from that perspective.
I know.
But
I got a plan.
What's your plan? How would you approach this, again, back in that Republican caucus who are clamoring for repeal and replace and, oh, yeah, we're going to promise, pre-existing conditions don't go away, but there is no plan. What's your plan?
Yeah, no, we got to actually come up with a plan. And I'll say this, there are some real problems, and the things that we can fix, like I said, the illegal mandate or the mandate that was in Obamacare, that was something that can easily been addressed. And I think we did go through a progress of addressing that. But the reality is, we can't have a situation where these insurance companies are for profit in this country. I mean, these insurance companies are killing us. That's where, you know, why you want to wonder why your premiums are going up, because you got so many people that are sick and we have no controls on these insurance companies. Now, look, I'm not going to be the one coming out here saying, hey, let's just get rid of the insurance companies. I know it's unreasonable to say that the American government is going to pay for universal health care for everybody. It's not real, right? That's not a that's a thing to get people excited, but it doesn't happen, right? The reality, what we can do is, you know, you think about the biggest expense for anyone dealing with illnesses in this country is medication, right? There's no reason for people to be in the United States to be paying 56% more than people in Mexico for the same drug. And the reality is because Medicare is not allowed to negotiate drug prices, that we do have that, you know, the pharmaceutical can sell us whatever drug at whatever price they want to, and we have to accept it under Medicare's guidelines. So what I want to do first and foremost, I want to make sure that Medicare is able to go and negotiate with these companies. We have to give them that leverage so that we can, you know, you bring us in line with the whatever this drug costs in Mexico, we need to be paying the same amount here in the United States. So, you know, that's the biggest part. Everything else is, you know, look, we got to start talking about let's start addressing the outside issues, right? We talk about healthcare. Let's talk about resources for improving healthcare. Let's talk about improving, like I talked about before, the lack of healthy choices for food in certain communities, right? You know, we can't put this burden, we can't make this burden so heavy on employers to have healthcare insurance for their workers to where employers are unable to afford to hire people. So we got to come up with some real solutions to fix this. And look, I'm willing to caucus with anybody to make this thing happen because I know the interests of the people are at stake. And if we don't fix it now, America is really going to be facing some major challenges going forward for the future.
How do you see our climate right now? Do you assess this as the vast majority of scientists have that climate change is real and there are a lot of causes, including human factors? How do you assess climate, and how would you, as a Republican member of Congress, express that so that you build a consensus towards addressing some of the serious matters that are beginning to emerge in the climate space?
Yeah, so look, let me preface it with this. In 1962, Ronald Reagan said the Democrat Party, I didn't lead the Democrat Party, the Democrat Party left me, mm-hmm. right? And that was the rationale behind that, is because the party, his party at the time, had moved so far left of realistic ideas to where he could no longer be a part of that. And I'm encouraging the Republican Party not to do the same with its own body, okay? Don't move so far right to where nothing makes sense and you lose your base, right? You lose people, real people that are looking for real solutions in their districts. At this point, from the environmental standpoint, we got to understand climate change is real, right? We see it happening in front of us, okay? The reality is that the United States alone can't tax itself out of that, okay? Okay. And and these ideas of imposing new taxes on these ideas so that on these environmental issues so that America can be, you know, this beacon of environmental change. We have to remember that there are other countries that have real, and this is environmental. We're talking about China. We're talking about India. They have major, environmental hazards. If we can't bring the international community on board with doing the same thing, then look, we're just kicking it in the wind. And what I don't want to do is place that unnecessary. Undue tax burden, because what I don't want to do is place on our American constituents when other countries are doing what they want to do, and they're still, creating more population. It'll take China 28 years to get to where America's quality of life is right now, quality of air is. And I think we got to be smart about that. We got to realize that America is just, you know, we're only a small puzzle, a small piece in this big puzzle of climate change. And I think as long as we do bring that to the table, where we're all working together and trying to figure out how to work with our international partners to fix it, then we can come up with a real solution.
You made some noise back in September that caused some heads to turn and I, you know, some folks to make that Scooby-Doo noise. You know, what is this brother talking about? When you came out in support of federal legislation for marijuana. The headline, which I love from this screaming, quote, GOP congressional candidate in Texas goes all out for marijuana reform ahead of the election. So tell us what your narrative is there, and how does this play into some of the policies that you referred, that you've been talking about, for example, in the healthcare space, and potentially in the economic space?
Yeah. So, you know what, a big part of my research, I mean, this was research based. It's not just me just throwing something against the wall, because look, I'm looking at COVID, right? In the wake of COVID, we've seen our retail businesses decimated, right? We've seen our restaurants decimated. Seen 56% of 46% of small and minority owned businesses are going out and not coming back. Okay. The only thing that survived during this whole process has been basically the online world, right? The Amazon, right? Mm-hmm. Amazon's the only one that saw this uptick in profits. Okay. Right. The reality is, what real engine is available for people to achieve and create something, right? To basically make money, to bring back their community. Well, I'm looking at everything possible, and I just didn't see anything. So I decided to take a trip out to Colorado. I went out, I met with politicians, I met with the police unions. You know, I had a chance to meet with two of some of the factories, go view the farms. Man, it's a sophisticated market. You know, this is, look, in my mind, now keep in mind, I'm thinking, okay, the hood, we don't need no more liquor stores on every corner. Right. In my mind, I'm smoke shots, right? And so when I get there and I see these sophisticated facilities, I'm like, man, this is okay. This is nice. And you talking Colorado last year made $1.6 billion for their economy off marijuana. That was the only market that didn't take a hit during the COVID-19 was the marijuana. Well, you got to use the technical term, the cannabis industry. Right. It didn't. So I'm saying, okay, let's use this to leverage opportunities for the inner cities, right? If you think about who's been hit the most by these war on drug policies in the 1970s, which Nixon basically said, okay, they're using marijuana, the inner cities using marijuana for recreational use. How about that become America's enemy number one?
Yeah, Schedule A. Yeah.
So what we did was we went in and all the arrests. I could go through these numbers all day long, but the bottom line is you had a majority of the arrests that was centrally targeting inner cities because of marijuana sales, marijuana use. So now, as I'm backing it up, I'm saying, look, you guys are making all this money. These other states are making all this money off of it. Now it's time to bring your urban majority minority districts to the table. Allow them to benefit from this same drug. It shouldn't have been a Schedule I drug to begin with. I can talk to you about that too.
Right.
Because it should have never been a Schedule I drug, right? Based on it having medicinal purposes, it was not addictive, and you know all the things the research supported, it shouldn't have never been a Schedule I drug. But I say that to say that the bottom line is we can use this growing industry that's been legalized in what, 33 states now, to improve opportunities, economic opportunities for majority minority districts. And that's by, you know, creating jobs, you know, creating, and this is a technical field. You know, there was a lot of things I didn't know about it, about, you know, how, you know,
the technology in this space is huge. I mean, it really drives a lot. I mean, just, it is not just growing a plant.
Oh, no. And what I will tell you is what I didn't like. Now, and that's, I think the good thing about research and actually seeing what happens on the ground is that you can see the flaws in what happens in those other systems, and you can come home and fix it, right? You can fix those things. Mm-hmm. What I didn't like was individuals being able to have their own plants, because you know what? You really can smell those plants in the communities, right? These are like, you know, you go into something like the Aurora community, the shooting happened at,
Columbine.
You know, Taliban. There you go. There you go. You can actually go into the community. You can smell it, right? So I'm saying that you probably need to put some kind of restraints on that, but the distributors are saying they didn't see any problems with, you know, sales, because there are people growing their own plants. They didn't see any problems with that. But I'm just looking at, you know, for the people that don't want to smell it all day long. Yeah, you're right. That probably.
At a certain point, you stop caring if you smell it.
Yeah, I get it. You know, I can see all the complaints that I talked to residents. I talked to the manufacturers. You know, I get it. I see.
Right.
I just be an economic engine that we need to get.
Before I let you get out of here, you also made news back in 2017 when you filed a federal lawsuit against Black Lives Matter, Facebook, Google, and Twitter on behalf of Jews, law enforcement, and others. What was that about, and why did you do that?
Yeah, so essentially what was happening was there was this radicalized ideology that was going forward where law enforcement officers were being attacked across this country. And they were using these social media platforms to incite violence against police. And essentially nobody knew anything about it. Nobody was really paying attention to it, to how these groups were organizing so fast. And the police agencies couldn't respond fast enough because they didn't know how these groups were coming together like this. Make a long story short, we had a shooting attack in Dallas and 5 police officers got killed, 2 of which were really good friends of mine. And that pushed me into advocacy. You know, it made me say I had to do something about it. So I went off and I filed these lawsuits to bring attention to what was happening. And 2017 was Facebook, Google, and Twitter. And basically what I was doing was I was challenging an outdated piece of legislation that these companies were using as shields for themselves, right? There's basically a piece of legislation called the Communication DC Act, 1996 Communication DC Act, Section 230. Which basically says that online service providers are immune for what third parties post on their platforms. Okay,
right.
So what they're saying is they're immune for what Black Lives Matter put on their platform, even though that platform is calling for killing Jews, calling for killing police officers, even though that information is their algorithms are pushing it to. Now we got to remember too, also in CDA 230, it also there's a caveat in there that says that the online service provider cannot act as a distributor, right? They can't manufacture and create the content, okay? And what these companies did through their algorithms, essentially, they are acting as distributors. They're pushing the content to individuals based on your likes, based on your preferences. That's how you get this information. And another thing that I pointed out was that how countries. There's a piece of legislation called 18 USC 2339, right? That's providing material support for terrorism, right? You're familiar with, you know, we saw a lot of that
come up
after 11. So if you think about these other countries are buying Facebook ads, right? And they're using social agendas that are impacting us here in America, and they're causing individuals to be ramped up. And guess what? These companies are accepting money from other countries to do that. That is domestic terrorism in the United States. By definition, is, you know, groups using force and intimidation for the purposes of changing, attacking governmental policy. So they're using, they're accepting foreign currency, right, to sow division in the United States, which is a form of domestic terrorism. And unfortunately, in bringing it up to the courts, the court said, we're unwilling to do Congress's job. Congress needs to repeal CDA 230. But until then, I'm granting them protection under CDA 230. And that's why I'm here today. We got to do something about that. And look, I appreciate everything you guys doing with the Coalition for a Safer World. I mean, this is, we're in a new world. And not a lot of people understand how social media is being used to destroy our country. But I'm glad you guys are in that space to where you can really keep pushing forward to change this to protect our interests.
Yeah, that is an important work right now. And I loved how you just sort of, you know, spit out that black letter law there like that. You just kind of let it rumble off the teeth there. Trey Penny is a good brother. So I said at the beginning of our conversation, folks, that I wanted you to hold off before you went to the you know, pennyforcongress.com site because I wanted you to hear this, brother. So when you made that show of support, you knew why you were doing it. He's a fine brother running for the 30th congressional seat in Texas. About 3 weeks out, you're looking good, you're feeling good, you're sounding good.
Feeling good.
Folks, I need you to check out pennyforcongress.com. Dig in a little bit more to what Trey's doing. And just like I had Jamie Harrison on the program many months ago, because he's a brother that not only is he from my backyard in South Carolina, but, you know, this is the new generation, Democrat, Republican, African-American men, both beating different drums, but actually kind of, you know, working towards the same goals. And it's a great pleasure to showcase what you're doing. And I wish you well, my friend. Be good out there.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me on.
All right. All right. So, folks, that does it for this time together. You know how it rolls. You know what I'm going to say. Do the download thing, because you know I love it when you do that download thing the way you do it. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spotify, wherever you get that download thing on. Don't forget to check us out on Twitter at Michael Steele. Check out my man's website, pennyforcongress.com. And you can follow him on Twitter at SGT, abbreviation for Sergeant, _Penny. That's SGT _Penny. Until next time, be safe. Be well. Vote. Don't forget your plan to vote. Let's get it together now. And please, wear the damn mask. Later.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.
Everyone loses golf balls, even the pros. When you need golf balls, go to LostGolfBalls.com, the world's largest inventory of used golf balls. All the top brands, in stock, 50% off retail. LostGolfBalls.com.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisisCLE.com/podcast.